As 2012 draws to its end, magazines and media proclaim the year's winners and losers. Publishers Weekly gets the party started early next week with its own announcement of book publishing's Person of the Year. And in reviews, the Motor City confronts the coroner with the autopsy performed by a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Welcome, everyone, to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. My name is Christopher Keneally, host of Beyond the Book, and each week on Friday, we turn to the writers and editors of Publishers Weekly for a look at the week ahead, a preview of the news that everyone in book publishing is talking about. Joining me from the offices of Publishers Weekly in New York City is Andrew Albanese, magazine's features editor, and welcome back, Andrew.
Greetings, Chris.
So I want you to tell us, but I know you can't, but we will get an announcement on Monday for the Pub Person of the Year from PW.
Oh, you know, I really, really want to tell you. I feel terrible not being able to reveal it first right here on this podcast. But yes, Monday's issue will be our Publishing Person of the Year. And all I can say really is that it's a very interesting choice for what's been a very interesting year in publishing.
Well, Andrew, though, you can tell us about some of the runners-up this year.
I can talk about a couple of the runners that I personally find very interesting. One is Nico Fund from Oxford University Press. Now, I have to, in full disclosure here, Nico and I are friends, and I'm a former employee at Oxford University Press. I was an editor there for a number of years. But I will say that the Oxford University Press, people think of them as this small little enigmatic operation. They clocked in at 18th on the world's largest publishers, and they are now a billion-dollar university press, the only billion-dollar university press that I've ever heard of. So Nico and their investment in digital, all of that stuff has been a really great story. So Oxford made the list. Also, Sheris Posen from the Department of Justice. Now, our publishing people of the year are not always for what they've done positively. And I don't think too many people in the publishing industry look kindly on what's going on with the DOJ. But nevertheless, we do talk about Sheris Posen and the impact that her actions at the Department of Justice are going to have on the industry in 2013.
Well, absolutely. Those are two interesting takes and just piques the curiosity as to who won out if those two were the runners up. Also, a lot of work for you this week getting ready for the ALA Midwinter Preview.
That's right. ALA Midwinter in January this year in Seattle, Washington, which is an absolutely lovely city to visit. Maybe not so much in January, but it's an absolutely wonderful place to go. And it's a city that loves its libraries. This year, they passed a levy to fund their library operations with well over 60% of the vote coming in approving of this. And you might remember in 1998, they built a magnificent Rem Koolhaas-designed central library and renovated every one of their 27 branches. So I think it's a great choice that ALA will be kicking off 2013 in a city that really loves its libraries like Seattle. By and large, I think 2012 was looked on as a year of frustration for libraries, namely because of the ebook library lending issue that's kind of simmered on. But one of the major focuses of our ALA package in Monday's issue is going to be that 2012 was actually a year of some stunning victories for libraries, namely in the legal and legislative realm. The library community had some major wins in some lawsuits it was facing, namely the Georgia State E-Reserves case, the HathiTrust case brought by the Authors Guild, and in another case over the UCLA's use of streaming video. First fair use passed with flying colors in all of those reviews, and it's really sort of emboldened libraries. But perhaps the most notable aspect of 2012 was the defeat of SOPA and this sort of new coalition that seems to have formed in Washington between libraries, tech companies, and these public advocacy groups. Copyright in the last few years has kind of gone mainstream. A lot of people are now involved with it. And if you think I'm wrong about that, just ask how many of your friends posted that Facebook hoax thing, putting up a fake copyright notice on their walls this week. More and more people are now involved with, even if they don't understand it, are more involved with what copyright is about. And the library community is really sort of latched onto that. And they think it bodes well for their future.
Well, if I can get a plug in, you mentioned people understanding and sometimes misunderstanding copyright. Clarence Center, of course, the sponsors of this podcast, offers a variety of educational programs online and on our website. So do go check out copyright.com/education if you've got some questions or want to learn more about what your rights and obligations are as authors and publishers. But continuing discussing about ALA on the library side of things, we've got some news coming from PW, a new contributing editor.
Absolutely. We have signed up Brian Kenny as a new contributing editor on our library for our library team. You probably know Brian. Brian was a former, until just last year, was a former publisher at Library Journal and School Library Journal. He was also editorial director here at Publishers Weekly for a brief time before Reed Elsevier and the divestment of the company and our new ownership here, George Slowick. So we're delighted to have Brian back in the fold to help us with our library coverage. His first piece, which is in this ALA issue, is a really wonderful observation on the whole ebook mess. Brian is now the director of the White Plains Public Library in White Plains, New York. So being back in the field and still having a very close relationship with the publishing community from his days there, he has some great observations to share.
Right. And your coverage of ALA will, of course, include postings from your own Peter Brantley.
Absolutely. Peter has a really great piece in this issue about copyright reform, which is something we also touched on in my Q&A with Brandon Butler from ARL. And it, particularly, it deals with the Republican Study Committee's memo on copyright reform that was released and then quickly buried 24 hours later. Peter actually talked to Derek Khanna, the author of that memo, who surprisingly was very reticent. There's a lot of no comments in there on a lot of questions that Peter asked. But he did have, you know, a few things to say that were very interesting. But the upshot of it is that we really are sort of edging towards this idea of finally getting really comprehensive copyright reform for the digital age. I don't expect it's going to be easy, and I don't expect it's going to happen quickly, but there definitely is a movement afoot.
Well, and finally, when it comes to this ebook mess, as you call it, give us an update where that all stands.
Well, you know, we're definitely going to be talking a lot about this in January at ALA. This week, the ALA released a media kit. It's really trying to take this case to the public. It's trying to help libraries to educate their local media about why they can't lend ebooks from certain publishers. They're also trying to help them communicate their frustrations better to their patrons. So it's a definite ramping up of ALA's new strategy here, which is to sort of try to ramp up the public pressure on publishers. There has been small amounts of progress that we can point to. For example, Macmillan has indicated that they are working on a project to get them into the library ebook and lending game in 2013. So that's potentially a positive. And Penguin has announced that it is expanding its pilot project with 3M to other vendors, notably Baker & Taylor, which is a great entrenched company in the library world, and that they're also going to start expanding that pilot to more libraries. What the wild card is there, of course, is the merger between Random House and Penguin. As you know, the two companies have very different ebook lending policies. Random House will sell to libraries its entire list for a markup, while Penguin still is not really involved, and they're not working with Overdrive. Random House, on the other hand, is working with Overdrive. So I don't really know what the upshot of Penguin expanding a pilot project is, when that pilot project may have no future within a merged company. So that is something that's sure to get a lot of attention in January in Seattle at ALA Midwinter.
Well, certainly. You know, you make a fascinating point there about some of the complications that are going to come out of the merger. It won't be simple, and that won't be the only one, I'm sure. You'll be watching all of that for us.
We certainly will.
Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly's Features Editor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And now we want to turn to Rose Fox, PW reviewer who blogs at Schomerville. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Rose.
Thank you, Chris.
And we've got a few books this week. As always, we'll start with fiction.
Yeah, in fiction, we felt that Jim Crace's 10th novel was kind of lackluster. That was PW's official opinion. But we also officially believe that he's returning to form with Harvest. This is an electrifying novel whose setting, an isolated English farming village in an unspecified past, is so imaginatively described that it stands as the book's richest character. Over this course of 7 days following the harvest, the hamlet is alight with sudden change. A mysterious fire burned the manor's stables, and three newcomers are blamed and punished. When one dies and a horse is found killed, accusations of witchcraft erupt. And the PW Review says that Crace's signature measured delivery and deliberate focus create unforgettable poetic passages that quiver with beauty. Also in fiction, The Love Song of Johnny Valentine is a sharply written novel from the Whiting Writers Award-winning author of Capitoil, and this is about a tween sensation who, not unlike a certain fever-inducing pop star, went from YouTube sensation to filling Madison Square Garden with bubblegum hits, and now every detail of young Johnny's life is micromanaged for mass appeal, and his stage mom rides shotgun on the tour, fending off normal to keep a good thing going. And the smart skewering of the media is wickedly on target, but our reviewer says the real accomplishment is the unforgettable voice of Johnny himself. And for our Q&A in fiction, we spoke with registered nurse Priscilla Sibley about the complicated ethics she brings to light in her debut novel, The Promise of Stardust. When asked if she ever felt pressure to come down on either side of the issues that her book explores, namely the right to die and abortion, the author said, "It had occurred to me that someone or some organization might take strong exception to what I've written. These are divisive issues in this country, but I did not set out to write a political statement. I wanted to write a human story."
In mystery and thrillers, you'll start off with a take on World War II that comes from an alternate universe.
Yep, fans of realistic alternative history thrillers will welcome this debut by Guy Saville. It's called The Afrika Reich, that's Africa with a K, and it imagines a world without World War II, in which the British made peace with Germany, who regained her former African colonies. Suspenseful action sequences, logical, enthralling plot twists, and characters with depth distinguish this tale about a retired English assassin who goes after a Nazi he believed to be dead, but who is now, in fact, the Governor General of the German colony of Congo. Also in mystery and thrillers, Carrie Greenwood, author of the lighthearted Frinny Fisher series set in the 1920s Australia, ventures into ancient Egypt with Out of the Black Land. And the new pharaoh Akhenaten sends the country into turmoil by promoting a heretical religious philosophy that there is only one god. And of course, those who worship the traditional deities are not pleased. And we have a Q&A with Alan Bradley, who's the author of Speaking from the Bones. That's the fifth in his series, set in early 1950s England and starring 11-year-old sleuth Flavia Deluce.
In science fiction, we have the arrival, a bit late, of a book by Argentine author Angelica Gorodischer.
Yes, this was written in 1979, and I'm glad you attempted to pronounce her name. My Spanish accent is terrible. I'd say Angelica, but I don't know. So Trafalgar is an understated and impressive story cycle, and this is a brand new translation, the first time it's been translated into English by Amalia Gladhart. And the book relates the adventures of an intergalactic trader and coffee addict, Trafalgar Medrano, who attempts to raise money by selling goods and services on other planets. But most of his efforts end in improbable, hilarious disaster, and all the things that happen, such as being mistaken for Mandrake the Magician or finding a world that looks exactly like Earth in 1492, are relayed in these stories of him sitting in a cafe and chatting with the proprietor who sort of stands in for the reader. And Gorodischer takes familiar tropes in entertaining directions that evoke their golden age roots and then transcend them with a layer of absurdism. And in romance, we cover A Good Man. This is a deceptively light but ocean-deep send-up of dating and reality television. Author J.J. Murray takes a fun, reflective look at interracial relationships. Sonia Richardson, who's a retired WNBA star, reluctantly agrees to serve as a role model for black women on a show where 12 men compete for the hand of what is described as a Nubian princess in search of her boo. And immediately she asks, why not a Nubian queen? And this is the first of many stereotype deflating moments. So John Bond, a white widower from Alabama, signs onto the show as one of Sonia's suitors. And in the ensuing melee, the pair must find their own way amid religious concerns and painfully revealed secrets. The religious elements are always uplifting and never overbearing. And our reviewer says that readers should brace for a three-hanky finale.
Well, in nonfiction, you've got a couple of books that look at the dark and the light side of human nature.
Yes, we have a pair of books wherein a psychologist and a historian weigh in on what it takes to be happy and what it means to be sad. In the provocative and fresh The Myths of Happiness, Sonia Lyubomirsky examines happiness and conventional notions about how it's nurtured in relationships, at work, and in one's own psyche. And while she remains sympathetic to her reader's pain, she demonstrates that positively reframing life events can mine the best out of even the darkest situations. Also, in How Everyone Became Depressed, The Rise and Fall of the Nervous Breakdown, Edward Shorter explores the devastatingly dark antithesis to Lyubomirsky's subject, depression. His fascinating history is captivating and hopeful. In Storm Kings, The Untold History of America's First Tornado Chasers, Lee Sandlin describes early efforts to document, predict, and better understand the despots of the plains. Legendary tempests roll through the text, from the funnel of fire that destroyed Peshtigo, Wisconsin in 1871, to the tri-state tornado of 1925 that rampaged for 219 miles across part of Missouri, Illinois, and Indiana. Sandlin makes talking about the weather much more than a conventional nicety. He really brings it brilliantly to life. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Charlie LaDuff delivers an edgy portrait of the decline, destruction, and possible redemption of his hometown in Detroit, An American Autopsy. Returning in 2008 after 20 years away, the former New York Times staff writer finds a city in its death throes. The big three car companies are begging for bailouts. Arsonists are burning down vacant buildings. Firefighters have faulty equipment. Ambulances take too long to arrive, and violent criminals walk the streets. And noting that Detroit is where America's way of life was built, LaDuff argues that the city is a microcosm of what's occurring in the rest of the country, with foreclosures, unemployment, and rising debt. In a spare and rather macho style with a discerning eye for telling details, LaDuff writes with honesty and compassion about a city that's destroying itself and breaking his heart. And finally, in nonfiction, amidst the profusion of strategy books, Playing to Win, How Strategy Really Works, by former Procter & Gamble CEO A.G. Laffley and Rotman School of Management Dean Roger L. Martin, is a clear standout in the field. It's sure to take its place on business students' bookshelves. And this engaging book draws on academic theory, but is deeply grounded in real-life corporate lessons, including mistakes, learned at P&G both before and throughout Laffley's tenure. Time Martin served as an advisor to the firm. And the authors ask basic practical questions that separate true strategy from mission, vision, or planning, asserting that the essence of strategy is about winning and the tough choices leaders and organizations need to make to achieve victory.
Well, you know, we're coming into December, Rose, and so it's a bit far off, but nevertheless, a good time to start thinking about gardening.
I could not make a garden happen this year, and I keep telling myself I'm going to plant it earlier every year, and I never do. But this is the book that would get me thinking about it again. The Speedy Vegetable Gardener by Mark Diacono and Linda Lindertz from Timber Press promises almost instant gratification in the garden by concentrating on veggies and edible flowers that can be reaped almost as quickly as they are sown. So while you're waiting for tomatoes, you can enjoy fennel microgreens. With each crop, the authors include cultivation advice and clear how-to photographs along simple recipes, so a reader can learn not only how to cultivate zucchini, but also how to harvest their flowers and serve them tempura style, which I particularly love, I must say.
Yeah, so do I. And, you know, I like the idea of, you know, these vegetables growing rather quickly because they'll grow faster than I can kill them, hopefully.
Well, as a New Yorker, I appreciate anything that happens fast.
That's right. Finally, in children's, what have we got?
In the children's YA section, we have a massive two-page roundup of new board books with titles from popular authors Karen Katz, Brian Biggs, and Tad Hills, among others. On the picture book side, there's a pair of biographies of note. Look Up, Henrietta Leavitt, Pioneering Woman Astronomer, is the story of a woman who helped other astronomers make significant gains in their ability to accurately measure stars at a greater distance from Earth than was previously possible. And the book is a collaboration between Robert Burley and Raoul Colon, both of whom have created numerous picture book biographies. We also review You Never Heard of Willie Mays by Jonah Winter and Terry Widener, which is a companion to Winter's excellent biography of Sandy Koufax. And it follows Mays' career trajectory from the Negro Leagues to the big leagues and finally to the Hall of Fame. And in nonfiction, we have a boxed review of Zeus Station, the story of Christian F. This is a new translation of a teen's memoir that was first published 35 years ago in Germany. It's the story of a German 12-year-old who moves to Berlin in the 1970s and quickly gets into the local drug scene, becoming a heroin addict and prostituting herself along with her boyfriend in order to support her habit. The original book inspired a film years ago with a David Bowie soundtrack, and this mesmerizing new translation makes Christiane's story readily accessible to a new generation. I've read an excerpt of this, and it is just harrowing.
Well, you know, there are so many David Bowie soundtracks and films out there that just have been forgotten over time, but that's probably one worth dragging back up and putting it on the player. Finally, pick of the week. We've got a book that launches Harlequin's new contemporary romance imprint.
Yeah, just in time for Valentine's Day. This is a February title by Kelly Hunt. Start Harlequin's contemporary romance imprint, Harlequin Kiss. And the book is called The One That Got Away. And our reviewer says it's an emotionally powerful and beautifully rendered love story. Evangeline Jones is a confident and successful businesswoman who agrees to marry her business partner so he can access his trust fund and invest in their company. Naturally, since they're going to be married, he introduces her to his family. And Evie is shocked to learn that her ex-lover, Logan, is her fiancé's half-brother. And Evie and Logan immediately start up with their smart, sleepy banter that leads to them hopping back in the sack. But tentative steps toward a relationship are hindered by old demons, secrets, and fears. So women who thrive on empowered women and dangerous men will relish this carefully crafted and very intense romance. It's short. It's what we call a category romance, which means it's novella length, but there's a lot in there, and it's got a modern, relevant voice. So our reviewer says it sets a very high bar for the new Kiss line. Well done, Harlequin.
Yeah, well, indeed. Congratulations on that new launch from the Harlequin company. And Rose Fox, thank you so much for this week's review of the reviews.
You're very welcome, Chris.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. Follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and subscribe to the podcast series on iTunes or at Copyright Clearance Center's website, copyright.com. Just click on Beyond the Book. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.